somebody said, yeah, well, they're just throwing it against the wall to see if it sticks. And I said, yeah, but they don't even know that they're throwing it at the right wall.
But for employees, you could also have policies. If this gets leaked out, these are the consequences.
It's a problem everywhere in retail, which is the people on the ground are getting orders from people who have no idea what's really going on the ground.
From Orion X, this is the Marketing Podcast. Marketing has transformed in significant ways. More technology, more data, more social, more blending of arts and sciences, more integrated with every other function, and ultimately more critical to the organization. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett as they discuss news and happenings in the world of marketing, from the boardroom to customer programs.
Hi, everybody. Marketing Podcast here once again. This is Shaheen Khan with Doug Garnett. How are you, Doug?
I'm doing well.
Excellent. Now, as you all know, we spend a good couple of hours before every recording solving the problems of the world, including some marketing ones. So we have a cartoon, Doug.
We do. In our cartoon, we have a gentleman, clearly a executive of some sort, standing in a suit and tie with a blindfold on his face. And he's throwing darts at a target. And only one of the about 15 darts has hit the target. And talks about typical marketing analytics. And he says, yeah, but look at how many darts I've thrown. And I just thought it summarized a lot of the vagueness of being in the marketing business these days.
Yeah, I think it summarizes the vagueness, but also some of the reality, right? Yeah. So I saw the cartoon and I was immediately thinking impressions. Mm-hmm. I've got thousands, if not millions of impressions, but I have no idea who actually...
No idea whether they're good ones or bad ones.
How many actually looked at it because it just showed up on their scroll. What are we actually counting? And then what was my targeting? Did I at least target the potential impressions properly or not?
Yep.
But then I also was thinking, you know, it's a fact of life that if you're way at the top of the funnel, where I think now you could have the same problem further down. And I think if you do, that really is a problem. Mm-hmm. But if you have it at top of the funnel, then the guy at least is facing the dart.
Yeah, that's right. At least he is. It is true. At least he's facing the target. I used to laugh in the direct response TV industry that somebody said, yeah, well, they're just throwing it against the wall to see if it sticks. And I said, yeah, but they don't even know if they're throwing it at the right wall.
And, that's right.
So I think there's a lot of ways that this could go. I actually thought a little bit more about cost per click and the hyper-targeting we've been in and things like that, because we've gotten so many marketing analytic approaches thrown at us. Like, mm-hmm. I invent a new media type. What do? I invent a new marketing analytic. And then it gets handed over to the marketer who invents a sub-marketing analytic based on that one. And all of a sudden, the executive committee spends most of its time trying to figure out what their marketing team is measuring and whether it matters at this point in time. And I think it's tricky, you know, look at how many metrics I've invented.
Yeah.
Do I get a reward for most marketing metrics invented?
Well, there was another cartoon about just making up whatever metric that makes you look good.
Yeah, if listeners haven't seen it, the Marketoonist has an excellent cartoon about inventing marketing analytics. It was a little too complex to try to walk through in a podcast format, so we'll let you look it up.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. But anyway, yeah, I think the top of the funnel, that's the problem. Because now, if you interpret the actual hitting of the dart board as a click, then his conversion isn't so bad.
Well, yeah, because he's getting one click out of 15.
One out of 15, you know, that's 7%, isn't it?
That's not bad. 1% is usually fairly good. So 7% works. Yeah.
Well, it all depends on your targeting, too. If it is a wide net, then maybe 1% is all you can hope for. But if it is a relatively well targeted, you could. But then how many are you leaving on the table, right?
But I think, you know, a lot of this is this reality that there is a problem in marketing that we're told to expect that this can be analytically handled and predicted. And I was talking with somebody earlier today about the value of models often is just getting us a starting point. I did, all the math I did was all based on iterative solutions where you start and you would very often just have to invent what's my starting guess. And then you would iterate until you found what worked. And I think there is value in that. If he didn't have blindfold on, I might give him more credit.
Right. All right. So another topic we discussed was Starbucks, something that we're all familiar with.
Yeah.
And they released their financial results. It missed expectations, presumably, because their stock dropped quite precipitously. And at least one of the remedies suggested had to do with marketing. So let's talk about that. You're okay. Really up to speed on this one. So
here's the what happened. Starbucks reported their Q2 results for 2024, which was the end of March. And net revenue was down by 2% worldwide. And their stock dropped 20%. I thought your first reaction to that headline was absolutely appropriate. So do you want to repeat what it was you said about a 2%?
What I read was their revenue dropped by 2% and the stock dropped by 20. And I'm saying, wow, really? Just for 2%?
Yeah.
Like you made $98 instead of 100. And I'm just going to have a big problem with that. Is that really? Sounds like there might be more to it. I don't know.
Well, I think it's a combination of, I do think that there's more to it, but I also think it's worth noting how weirdly sensitive the stock world is to anything they decide is bad news, whether it is or not. And I mean, the reality of doing business is stuff, some stuff goes up, some stuff goes down. What you want to do as a company is in the overall, you want to end up. But you can't control quarter by quarter exactly what's going to happen. There's consumer trends, there's inflationary trends, there's all kinds of stuff that affects it. So at some level, I'm fully with you about really 2% drop leads to a 20% stock drop. Digging into it, there is some news that's a little more concerning. It turns out in the U.S., compared a year ago, they were up famously. The same quarter a year ago, they were up by 12%. This year, they're down by 3% in the U.S. Okay, I can see why people might be a little stunned by that. It still leaves me a little bit in between, because when I think, okay, it went up by 12%, I want to know why. You know, what was going on that led to a 12% increase? And what was not going on that led to a 3% decrease? The other thing is that their store comps were not very good. So they had a 7% decline in orders, a 4% increase in average ticket price. And what made it only 2 or 3% in the U.S. was that they grew a lot of new stores, 5% store growth over the past 12 months. So looking at all that, I'm like, well, there's probably reason for concern. I'm still not at a 20% concern in terms of stock, but there is reason for concern.
But it looks like they also had weak guidance. And I think a lot of the Wall Street activity is all forward-looking.
Yep.
That if you had a terrible quarter, you would be immediately forgiven if you're projecting tremendous growth coming. But then also the fact that you missed means your ability to predict is a little bit in question.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, we won't get into prediction because as a complexity guy, they have a whole, we could spend hours on that question. But
right.
I mean, actually, the truth is our ability to predict is always bad. And a lot of times the only way to be able to predict reliably is to restrict how much we want to do. So if we're willing to go to mediocrity, we can predict reliably. Well, I'm not sure that's a good business choice,
yeah,
to be honest.
No, I remember in the old days when we were trying to sell supercomputers and it was really hard to do so. And we were also competing with gaggles of workstations where we had folks who were doing that.
Yeah,
I think our sales guy's joke was that the workstation sales guys would forecast revenue only after an order came through the fax machine.
And those are lovely times to live within. So
yes, yeah, that's
absolutely
right.
Lovely times.
I will forecast this deal will come through, and it's already come through.
So where this begins to transition into marketing, let's shift there, which is, we're looking at the Seattle Times article about this, which is off of AP, I believe. And I was surprised because founder and former CEO Howard Schultz made public comments. Now, he's currently the emeritus chairman, which is retired chairman, but still involved. And he literally was essentially the founder of Starbucks. Technically, it was founded 18 years before he bought it, but it never became Starbucks until he bought it. So anyway, and he made some comments that were a little on the striking side. The first one that got to me is he said, the go-to-market strategy needs to be overhauled and elevated with coffee-forward innovation. And my eyes glazed over halfway through that comment. So fortunately, you and I looked further. And he also says, I have emphasized the company's fix needs to begin at home. U.S. operations are the primary reason for the company's fall from grace. And then I'm going to skip a sentence I dislike and say, the answer does not lie in the data, but in the stores. And I think that's where our marketing connection comes. If you're Starbucks, in fact, your success depends entirely on what's going on in the stores. And that's where I come back to marketing is, all right, what is going on in the stores?
Yeah, you've brought that up in our previous episodes in the context of retail in general, where you've talked about micromanagement with micro data and losing the recipe in the process. I was thinking about, is it really about the balance between a big brand where customers go because they know what to expect and it's trusted versus like a local artisanal shop that you might think might do better, but also maybe not. So is that what's going on? Or is it that they've been messing with the formula, like you mentioned, maybe the middle managers have been messing with them?
My opinion, and this is based on, you know, a fair amount of research, but I am not an employee of Starbucks and I do not have any insider information. However, I have talked to a lot of baristas and a lot of people who have worked for Starbucks, as well as reading, you know, Howard Schultz's book and, you know, doing a fair amount of due diligence around it, looking at articles and the like. And I think what I'm concerned about is it sure looks to me like they've got too many layers of middle management, and that middle management needs something to do, so they muck with the stores. And it's a problem everywhere in retail, which is the people on the ground are getting orders from people who have no idea what's really going on the ground. And it's the same as being in the military, where the guys in Washington, D.C. say, well, go take that hill, and being on the ground, but you realize there's not actually a hill there. That they're all maps, you know, and I think that happens in retail all the time. And as I was saying earlier, if I, you know, complexity talks about self-organization, that there's tremendous potential for people to self-organize and especially to do that within limits. So if I was in Starbucks shoes, I would start with something is screwed up with how stores perceive themselves and are allowed to manage. And I believe from what I can tell, all authority has been taken away from the stores, and yet they continue to have huge responsibility for hitting micrometrics. Mm-hmm. And that is the worst situation for employee satisfaction. There's no way that they're going to get the right things happening in that situation. So, you know, they're having troubles hiring people. Well, would you want to go work in that environment? And that environment, I think, is why they've unionized. And there's a lot of evidence that something at the store is really out of whack. My sense when I hear about things like store employees being afraid of being punished, metrics should never be used for punishment. What the heck is going on over there? I'm trying to clean up my language. You know, what the heck is going on over there? Because that doesn't, you know, that doesn't make any sense. You're not going to motivate a store by giving them reprimands. And it's getting so bad, you get this feeling that employees are asked to paste smiles on their face and act in certain ways, similar to Jennifer Aniston in Office Space and her need for flair to impress her bosses. And it just feels like Starbucks and Jennifer Aniston wearing flair are far too close. And if I was in Starbucks executive suite right now, that's where I would have my
You'd worry about that. Yeah. Also in a business like this, where employee satisfaction has a direct impact on not just customer satisfaction, but whether or not they're going to come back.
Well, there are reports out there of customers who tell employees that everybody seems stressed at the store. Now, that's never a good sign. You know, customers should not be able to tell when mismanagement is occurring. And the fact that there are, you know, published reports of that happening should be of tremendous concern to anybody at Starbucks.
So we both agreed that his comment about it's not the data, it's the store really rang true. Mm-hmm. Of course, Coffee Forward lost me too. I thought that, you know, I can understand if it's like some internal branding that they want to do to talk about the next phase or what do they do. And let's rally behind this label that is different. That I understand, and maybe that's what it is. But then when they say go to market needs to be overhauled, are they talking about the sales channel that they have? We talked a little bit about that, about in-store versus mobile app versus drive-through.
That's a really good question. And I have some concern that they're mucking with the formula. And this is why I was surprised to hear that from Schultz. That sounds like they're trying to muck with the formula. And that's a way to kill Starbucks off, because we go there for a reliable experience. And it's good to add new things into that experience, but it's really important to protect that experience as well.
Is that part of what they're talking about when they say, let's overhaul the go-to-market plan?
I don't know. Maybe that's what he means, or maybe he knows that, you know, investors are going to be listening to him as a board member. And so you always have to have the word innovation in anything you say.
And, right. Well, he didn't mention AI, so he gets credit for that too.
Yeah, true.
And I think he's generally pretty universally liked, so he really is in a position to comment. And of course, because he was, of course, the guiding light of the whole thing for so many years and made it happen, so he's got the spiritual as well as the gubernatorial authority to talk about it.
To talk about this stuff, yes.
But at the end, they were down. They were down 2% in revenue. And if you double click on that, it looks like there's more down in certain places than others.
Yeah, they've got some problems overseas. He's suggesting that, you know, I mean, I think what I read in Schultz's comment is, yeah, there's some problems overseas, but would you guys focus on home? Because that's real. And I agree with him on that one. I think what we should get to, though, is this other data came out almost the same one in a report from CX Dive that says Starbucks mobile ordering is so popular, it's slowing some orders down. And I agree with that. I mean, I'm a Starbucks fairly regular, not regular as I used to be, because I have a local coffee shop I visit more. But I hate mobile orders because I'm a store guy. I go into the store and then I have to fight with how many people have mobile ordered before me to figure out if it's going to be a 20 or 30 minute wait or the usual two. And so I dislike those. Well, what comes out in this article is that apparently 3 out of 10 orders at Starbucks are received through the app. And when I hear that's a really serious problem for the stores, because you've got 3 types of orders in the stores. You've got app submitted orders, you've got drive up orders, and you've got people who walk in. And the poor employees are put in a position of trying to make all of those people happy. And that's nearly an impossible mission.
Why couldn't they just have a policy that the person there takes priority?
Well, that's what I would want to see as a customer. But I think it's a problem because their promise with the mobile order is, well, you put your order in advance, they're able to prioritize it so it's ready when you arrive. So that you walk in, pick it up, walk out, and it's a minimum time in the store. And I think that then that's what they promise through the mobile app. And maybe one of these situations where that's a lovely idea, but maybe it's not really reality, because they do say that a mid-teens percent of mobile orders went uncompleted. And I read that as abandoned in the shopping cart.
Right.
Long wait times. It could be I got most of the way there and all of a sudden I realized it was at the store, so why order mobily? Or it could be I realized I had something to do. I got a phone call. I got to go do something.
Exactly.
So I don't actually see that so much as a problem, as much as Starbucks has a marketing question of how much do you emphasize this 30% of orders?
Right. Yeah, I do like my gut reaction. I don't have all the data, and I would question whether they do.
Me too. Yeah.
But I don't know. My gut reaction is that if I'm there in person, they would do well to prioritize those who are physically there.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, I mean, there's no, what we know from retail is there's nobody more powerful for you than the person who walks in the store and orders there. You know, I would expect people ordering in the store order more on average. I don't know that, but that's generally typical in retail. I certainly could explain it because standing in line, I see that, oh, there's that thing I need for lunch. I pick it up. I am looking at the cups and things that they sell. I'm able to see everything that could go into the shopping cart. So generally the shopping cart is more full.
I mean, I can see the mobile order for those who may not order it otherwise.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I don't have time to go into the store, but do they have a mobile and drive-through too?
They also have drive-through. That's a separate issue. Yes.
But do they have the combination where you order on mobile and then you pick up with drive-through rather than go in?
I will defer because I don't know that answer. I think there's a lot of complications to it. I guess here's the major question for me, and this is, I think, one of the problems we have every time we look at one of these narrow order categories, is if they didn't have mobile, how many of those orders would they get anyway?
Right, exactly.
So, for example, if 30 out of 100 orders are placed via the mobile app, Would they get 15 of those anyway without the mobile app? That's hard to know, but it's a really important question.
Right.
Because a lot of times companies put these things in to make shareholders happy or so that some executive can claim to have implemented XYZ process. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it may turn out that XYZ process doesn't have a bottom line impact for them and could be more distracting and more damaging for customer satisfaction than they know. I suspect here they are getting a significant number of orders. If you've just lost 2% of revenue, you don't want to give up 15 out of 100 orders. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I don't disagree with that at all. But I do wonder if they've got the balance right, because their job is a whole business and not to maximize mobile orders.
So we had another topic.
Okay.
And that was Jen Hartman's tweet on communications, whether they are private or public. You want to tee that up?
Sure. Jen Hartman, if you don't know, she runs community PR work for John Deere. Yes, tractors and lawnmowers and equipment and all those kinds of things. We had her on a podcast a few years back, and she's very smart and very experienced yes. in PR. So she puts out this tweet that says, "My PR tweet, peeps, I'd love you to weigh in. In 4 short years, I've witnessed a dramatic shift in any organization's ability to communicate internally. The shift is they can't. Every memo, conversation, town hall has to be designed as if it's already external. Have there been any changes in how you work with employee communications?" And I responded immediately to it because I think she's right. And I've been following. She's been running into some real serious challenges where stuff that should be internal to the company gets put out into the public on social media. And as a company, you know, any company that has that happen has to sort out how to handle it and what to do in response. You had some very strong opinions too on it.
Yeah, I think that it's private versus public versus trust. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, things do get out. Mm-hmm. And I know in the old days when I was at Sun Microsystems, the rule was that every email you send is liable to be a headline in CNN, you know? Mm-hmm. So be careful what you put out there. But also that's a company that was pretty much at the forefront of digital communication. Mm-hmm. It knew that these things could be taken out of context, etc. But really the flip side is that if you were not there personally, to what extent do you trust what it is that you heard? And, you know, like you have said, you don't see the body language, you don't see the context, you don't know what else was said, and you just get a snippet of it. And even if you get the full recording of it, you are still not there. So your ability to interpret the data is suspect. So there's that, but it doesn't mean it can't cause a problem for you if it gets out there in the wrong hand. So I'll have more to say after your comment. Yeah.
No, I think absolutely that is true. You know, and I think the problem that she refers to here is if stuff gets out into social media, you lose all control to say, but wait a minute, you don't have the context of that. You know, we see it in very public things that happen around trials. I won't name any specific ones, but, you know, it's just a reality that once it's out there on social, you lose full control of being able to say, no, wait a minute, this is what we meant. There's a lot of the this is what we meant stuff that when you say it will come across badly. In my experience is very often you're better off just to either apologize and walk away or hunker down. But attempting to explain that context doesn't work once it's burst onto the, you know, onto the social media world and people have already decided that you guys must be slime.
Yes.
Because of that.
You could also hopefully help the situation with policies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So for speakers, the policy is assume you're public. Mm-hmm. So pick your words carefully, build the context. It's a little laborious, but it actually is not bad experience. It's not bad training. That basically means that everybody's a spokesperson, needs to go through spokesperson training, etc. But for employees, you could also have policies that says if this gets leaked out and we find out who did it, these are the consequences. There are companies that are really better at it than others. Apple comes to mind. I don't know how good they are these days, but historically, they've been great at keeping the lid on new product introductions.
And it's been interesting at Apple because a lot of people in the Valley, quotes Valley, have attacked him and said, oh, but everything should be public. And as a business guy, of course, I was on secret projects at one point in time. Maybe I'm just used to the idea that not everybody needs to know everything. But it just seems natural to me to say, no, you want to protect your plans until you're ready for them to go public. I think back with this, maybe the best analogy for some of this is that I doing focus groups had a policy that we would never do transcripts because we would often get asked for transcripts, you know, just get a literal word by word transcript out of the focus groups. And I would say no, because you only understand the focus group by being there in the room, because the communication includes how people interact with each other, includes the tone of voice they use, includes body language while they're speaking. There is, you know, I mean, in a way, the transcript captures perhaps a quarter of the communication.
Right.
And so to rely on transcripts or to rely on a video clip out of a meeting at a company always involves taking it out of context. And people love on social media these days to respond to things out of context. And
Yeah. In agreement with you and her, that seems to be the case now. It really is difficult to keep things private.
It does. And it leads me to a very big concern. And I think this is one that's more a society-wide concern. And I've seen it especially in government, where people say, well, we need full transparency. We need a recording of every meeting that ever happens in the government. And I've got a problem with that because, as you and I know from our work, if you're trying to solve a big, hairy, thorny, god-awful problem, you need to be able to get in a room with a bunch of people and just talk about it. And you need the room to talk and say something stupid because somebody else might respond to what you said with a good idea. But they only get their good idea if you say that stupid thing. And if you don't give people the room to explore what might be dumb ideas, you never, or seen from the outside as dumb ideas, you never get the good ones.
And, no, you're absolutely right. You know, and really the simple form of that is the devil's advocate.
Mm-hmm.
When you make a case for something that you emphatically do not believe in, you just want the discussion and do scenario planning. And you can't do that if you're...
Yeah.
If everything you say can be quoted out of context against you, right? So you do need the safe space to be able to discuss all of these things.
I mean, I feel for politicians because everything they do seems to be recorded. And, you know, if somebody asks a politician, you know, somehow I would love to hear, well, I was thinking about this and it sounded interesting, but then I think we have this challenge. But if they do that, it's going to be micro parsed by somebody and turned into something that is really damaging to them.
That's absolutely right. They say, what if this is the case? And say, oh, you believe that. No, I don't believe that. I just said, what if?
Yeah, that's right. Well, actually, we have the worst example of that in business is a Deming quote. This was a quote from W. Edwards Deming, who said, there are people who say, quote, if it can't be measured, it can't be managed, end quote. But much that matters in business can't be measured and has to be managed anyway. That's what he said. Well, all people do is they take that bit in the quotes and they say, well, Deming said, if it can't be measured, it can't be managed. And all of a sudden we have this bit that is torturing us, you know, through the world because it was misquoted and taken out of context.
That's right. So let's end with our favorite topic, AI.
So Tom Goodwin, who talks about a lot of things that are going on the web, some of which I agree with him on, some I don't. But that's the beauty of Twitter, is that you get to agree or not agree. But he put out a post on Twitter that said, I think CEOs like AI, not because it'll take many jobs or will lower costs, but because it allows them to suspend reality and critical thought for a few more years. And then he says, just wait, keep me in the seat and all will be fine. But we probably ought to make sure we thoroughly understand what this seems to be saying first, would you?
You know, my immediate reaction when I saw that was, well, that's not true. There are quite a few CEOs who aren't seeing it as a vehicle for just kicking the can, let's say, if I'm interpreting that correctly. There are those who really do see it as a new tool that they need to get busy figuring out.
Mm-hmm.
But then in our pre-call, when you and I were talking about, you were pointing out to some interpretation of that quote that also ring true.
Yeah, I think to me what it says is there are CEOs who are embracing AI not because it matters to their company, but because by doing that, they're able to suspend investor expectations for a few years, hoping that, yeah, results will suck right now, but they'll be better by the time we do this AI. A Hail Mary pass of give me a few more years because we're doing AI, whatever that means.
Yeah. That's right. So I think, you know, that also seems right that there would be those who would do that. Clearly, AI is just such an imperative that you could just assume correctly that it's a topic of discussion in every board meeting, in every management meeting, What are we doing about AI? What should we be doing about AI? And if you're a CEO and you can point to action, if you can say, look, these are the steps we just took, and we did this, we did that, we're doing this, here's a plan, you certainly have a narrative that can, that allows you to respond to that request and to respond showing action, showing planning, showing execution. And will that buy you more time? Yeah, I think it does.
Well, I think that's our challenge, is that sometimes it's a perfectly valid statement and all the right stuff's being done and it's a good thing. Unfortunately, there are times when it's being used as an excuse to avoid having to confront bigger issues. Mm-hmm. I think I'm reminded of the period from 2005 through, call it 2020. That's a long period of time where every retail CEO had to talk first and foremost about their what they were doing to increase online sales.
Right,
and
that's
it
true.
It became this absolute mandatory. And I think what we will eventually be able to see clearly is that a lot of stores wasted their opportunity to create a strong ability to survive. Because instead of focusing on their advantage, which was the stores, they spent too much money on this thing that was used to cut themselves some slack. Oh, yeah, we're working on online orders. We've got this project going, that project going. What about the storage? Oh, don't worry about that right now, because we've got to crack this. And this is the way of the future, is omnichannel. And I might point fingers at Macy's, I think, did that. Sears clearly did that. But a fair number of other stores did as well. And you can look at store health almost related to when they stopped doing that. And the ones that stopped earlier tend to be healthier today. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing I'm expecting with AI, that certainly in retail, a lot of retailers talking a lot of hype about AI that really isn't meaningful. I have yet to see a meaningful real retail example. So if I was in retail, what I'd want to hear from a CEO is, we have a very important project looking at how do we use AI, and I've given them full, you know, support. Now let's talk about what's really important, and let's go back to the store. And I'll give one example that happened this weekend, which is my wife and I were out, and I dropped into a Barnes & Noble, a new one in Tannisbourne Square in out west of Portland, and I was stunned. I've been critical of Barnes & Noble in the past. Somehow their stores didn't feel like book places, and it just didn't feel bookish or bookstore-like or whatever. I thought the environment was really quite messed up. Mm-hmm. This store was brilliant. And their results have started to do well in the past year or two. So I think that it's these things about where is your biggest bang for the buck, and don't get distracted by the latest shiny bauble. Investigate AI, but don't take your eyes off of what's most important for you.
So at the end, nothing replaces actual competence, not data.
That's true. Yeah, maybe there we go back to, you know, Howard Schultz, and every company needs to have its Howard Schultz comment about it's not the data, it's the whatever it is.
It's the store, it's the customer, it's the actual understanding of what it takes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not a shiny object. It's not the, yeah, exactly. All right, so maybe on that note, we could conclude this episode.
Sounds good. Happy spring to everybody. Hopefully flowers are bursting out around the Northern Hemisphere, and my apologies to those in the Southern Hemisphere. I know you're entering fall and going towards winter, sorry about that.
That's right. So, you know, we need every holiday twice.
Yeah.
Once for the Southern, one for... All right. That sounds good. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Doug. Until next time. Take care.
That's it for this episode of The Marketing Podcast. Every episode is posted on orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Marketing Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.